My guest on Takes on the World today is Professor Edward Wasserman, Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, who writes and lectures widely on the ethics and operations of the news media. He not only writes and speaks about the media, he is a veteran of 30 years as a newsman himself, having worked as a reporter, editor, columnist, and CEO for newspapers and news organizations in Maryland, Wyoming, Florida, and New York. Somehow he found the time to get a BA cum laude in politics and economics from Yale, a licence in philosophy from the University of Paris, Pantheon Sorbonne, and a PhD in media politics and economics from the London School of Economics. Professor Wasserman also held the Knight Foundation Chair in Journalism Ethics at Washington and Lee University from 2003 through 2012, and for 15 years a weekly column on the media and McClatchy Tribune Syndicate, and has spoken on the subject across the globe and is a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Media Ethics. On April 27th, he published an op-ed in the New York Times on one of the most controversial subjects, the most unusual and controversial individuals of our time, Julian Assange and the War on Whistleblowers, which we will discuss today. Welcome to Takes on the World, Professor Edward Wasserman.
Well, thanks for having me. Well, please call me Ed.
I'll call you Ed. All right. You begin your New York Times article by pointing out that the journalism mainstream views Julian Assange as less a hero than a conundrum. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, sure. I think that he represents a kind of a puzzling situation. It's a guy who apparently has broken the law. He's also made available tremendously valuable secret information that got worldwide distribution. And the media themselves have benefited tremendously from that. People got Pulitzer Prizes for running the information that he made available to them that originally was leaked to him by Chelsea Manning, who was then an Army specialist in Afghanistan, I believe. It might have been Iraq. The media have benefited from him, and they believe that the information he made available was of great public value, and yet they are uncomfortable by the fact that he broke the law to do it. They're uncomfortable about him because they don't really know where his loyalties lie, and in subsequent years after the 2010 leaks that made a great splash worldwide, he was associated with leaks that seemed to be doing the bidding of fairly disreputable players, namely the Russian government, and the information that that embarrassed the Hillary Clinton campaign during the 2016 election. So they began to wonder whose side he's on. So he becomes a sort of, I guess I was trying to use Assange as kind of an exemplary case of media ambivalence toward their own sources. And one of the things that's annoyed me over the years is the unwillingness of the media to stand up for their sources and to refuse the notion that perhaps these sources have rights of their own and perhaps they need protecting. So that's, I guess, where I was going when I described him as being as posing a conundrum to the media.
Well, I know he's referred as a scumbag and a dirtbag. One journalist, Washington Post Paul Wolman, said in the beginning an op-ed piece saying, we could all agree that Julian Assange is a dirtbag.
I'm not sure we all agree to that, but yeah.
That does represent,
I think that gives a fairly faithful expression to this sense of that you deal with Assange and whistleblowers like him because you have to, not because you like to, and not because you necessarily approve of them personally. And Assange himself has managed to offend just about everybody that he's collaborated with. That doesn't stop them from collaborating with him because the information he provides is, by and large, accurate, truthful, and oftentimes quite significant.
But he does have a number of international defenders who may not know him personally or so, who may have known him personally. But the fact that he's being seen as being persecuted for having released information that the public, we, let's say, had a right to know,
Yeah, that's right. And he has been published. He was essentially under house arrest for, 7 years at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And you can't argue that he has not been punished for what he's done in the same way that Chelsea Manning did, I believe, 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by President Obama. Edward Snowden is still in exile in Moscow under indictment for violating the Espionage Act. And Snowden was particularly egregious because he blew the whistle on domestic surveillance that was later judged to be illegal. So the NSA had no business doing what he exposed, and yet he's the only person being punished. And I guess strikes me as unjust, but what I was really focused on in the column is why the media have been so supine and so accepting of this of the punishment of their most indispensable resource, which is the source. First Amendment freedoms of the press are of no consequence and no value and have no meaning unless you have people willing to talk to the press. And you're not going to have people willing to talk to the press, they're getting jailed. And our First Amendment protections kind of extend to reporters, and reporters are rarely, if ever, prosecuted for printing secrets given to them by other people, but the people who give them the secrets are prosecuted. And so you have this strange situation where, you're not going to sweat the source, you're not going to sweat the reporter, you're not going to subpoena the reporter and force them to testify under the threat of being jailed if they refuse. So I guess the First Amendment is okay because the media is okay. But that's not exactly the case. What good does it do to protect the reporter if their source is being taken out back and shot? So that kind of freedom of the press becomes meaningless at that point.
Well, you actually pointed out back in an article in 2013 that the United States is uniquely harsh in its panic over government secrets, that we actually enforce, crack down on whistleblowers and those who expose government deceptions or falsehoods or back alley deals than any other country, that this is our supposedly free democracy here is much harsher on those who expose the truth than our allies. Perhaps you'll elaborate on
that. That's right. I'm not sure it's true of any other country. I wouldn't want to be a source of leaked secrets in China or Russia, but certainly the countries that we typically compare ourselves with, because we have the same respect for freedoms we're dedicated to the principle of open government and transparency and all the like. Certainly we are much harsher than they are. And because typically the kinds of leaks that need protecting are leaks that expose governmental corruption or misconduct. And certainly you can't at the same time want to see that kind of wrongdoing exposed and then punish the people who do the exposing. But the European Union is far more lenient when it comes to the way it handles whistleblowers. And most other countries here, an interesting dimension of this is that most other countries allow a whistleblower to make the claim that, yes, I did break the law by exposing this information, but I'm going to go to court and I'm going to claim that the public benefited from that exposure. And the public benefit defense is something other countries recognize and we do not. So you can't make the claim that Chelsea Manning, for example, by leaking the footage of the American Army helicopter killing civilians in Baghdad in, I think, 2004, that leaking that footage exposed a war crime, and it should have been leaked, and it should have been punished. She was not able to make that claim when she was brought to trial because the public benefit defense is not part of our array of ways to explain and justify violations of official secrecy. If you violate the secrecy, for that reason alone, you're guilty. And that's all there is to it, regardless of how egregious the wrongdoing is that you've exposed.
Well, she right now has been in jail for 2 months because she has refused to testify before a Virginia grand jury against Assange. There's been very little, I haven't seen any editorial comment criticizing that decision. She already has served 7 years of a 35-year sentence, and here she's back for refusing to testify and being held in jail until she agrees to do so. And on Monday, she demanded to be released and saying she's not going to testify under any circumstances. And yet, this is ignored by the mainstream media.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that's deplorable. I do think that she deserves, her case deserves greater attention. But, you know, when she went to trial, the military tribunal, it was not very well covered. I think the New York Times and maybe a couple other mainstream news organizations covered that. But for the most part, they just turned their back. And I don't know what that I fear for what happens to the flow of significant information to the public. You know, we don't know now. And there have been, seven espionage prosecutions under Bush, Obama, and now Trump. We don't know how many other investigations are underway. And all of these are espionage prosecutions for people who've leaked to the public. This is not espionage in the sense of giving secrets to our enemies or selling secrets and that kind of thing. This is not that at all. These are people who are aware of things that they believe the public should know about and who are making that information available to the news media, and they're being prosecuted for that. It's being called espionage. In this case, they've arrested Assange right now is facing a charge of basically assisting Chelsea Manning and coaching Chelsea Manning in how to provide information in a way that would keep Manning from being detected. That's a different charge than espionage. What they want to do is get better information from Manning that would basically put Assange in a position of being a co-conspirator rather than a functioning as a media person and taking information from a source. Instead of accepting information from the source, the allegation is that Assange actively collaborated and conspired with Assange and therefore can be charged with espionage. And that's what they want Chelsea Manning to confirm, and that's what she is refusing to do.
One thing that has troubled me almost from the very beginning, well, shortly after the WikiLeaks papers were revealed, the cables revealed, was the preoccupation of the media across the political spectrum more with the personality of Julian Assange than with the contents of what he actually leaked. And this has persisted as if, we have our news magazines that replaced we once had some excellent news magazines when I was younger, Look magazine, Life, not the one that you see today, but that were actually good news magazines.
Oh, man, it kind of dates you, doesn't it?
It does. And what happened is we went to people, us, me, all this personality-centered news, and on television as well. And what passes, and we actually used to have good TV news. I remember Cronkite, Peter Jennings. There were serious journalists, even Dan Rather at times. But today, it's become a joke. And it's almost like a quiz shows, but a different, it's a personality-driven operation, and we get very little hard news. And what's interesting is that, and Julian Assange has written about this, actually, that journalists seem to be unwilling at this point in time, or the last few years, to use any of his material as sources for what's going on in Syria or Venezuela. And cables around Venezuela indicate that the United States have been trying to undermine through the National Endowment of Democracy and its Republican and Democratic branches, has been buying the opposition going back to the early days of Cesar Chavez. And this is not a secret. You could go online and find all this material, and yet none of our mainstream news media even bothered to do that.
That's amazing. I mean, listen, it would be nice to say that this preoccupation with personality and this temptation to kind of reduce matters of grave public policy to a clash of individuals or the product of quirks and personality defects. It'd be nice to say that that's something new, but the media have always preferred that. It's easier, it's more accessible, it doesn't require that much shoe leather reporting, and it's something that they believe the reader relates more readily to. So they've done that. They did that to Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers. There was a lot of coverage of him, and Ellsberg says that at one point there was a very unflattering profile of him in the New York Times that actually interfered with his ability to raise money for his own defense. You know, people look at the Pentagon Papers as a moment of media of guts and glory, and it is true that they won an important case before the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court ruled that the Nixon administration could not enjoin publication of the Pentagon Papers beforehand. And that was an important victory. But they never did rule on whether the publication of the Pentagon Papers could be prosecuted as a violation of the Espionage Act. And nor did the victory in the Supreme Court that the Times and the other news organizations won, that didn't keep the government from continuing to try to prosecute Dan Ellsberg and his co-defendant for another 2 years. And they were left, twisting in the wind there without any help from the media, even though the media benefited enormously, and so did the public, from the publication of the Pentagon Papers. So, I'm sort of pointing out that this abandonment of sources is something that has, unfortunately, a proud tradition.
My guest is Professor Ed Wasserman, Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism, UC Berkeley, and we're talking about whistleblowing Julian Assange. I also wanted to mention Edward Snowden. Is that I remember journalists were saying, well, Edward Snowden should come back to the United States and face trial in court, as if he would have a chance of being acquitted. It's extraordinary, the kind of hypocrisy within the mainstream media that's holier than thou. And you write in this article how mainstream journalists, or quote-unquote journalists, want to determine who is and who isn't a journalist. And of course, the digital era has changed everything, even what a photograph reveals or what it doesn't reveal. Perhaps you could comment on the impact of the digital era and the concept of fake news.
Well, and now remember, now we're not really dealing with fake news in these instances, because one of the things that is distinguishing about the whistleblowing cases that we've looked at is that the information they've made available has all been solid. And often, this is not a matter of people peddling stories that aren't true. They're peddling stories that are clearly true and are extremely awkward and embarrassing for people in power. So we're not so much. I'm not sure that we are on solid ground in seeing this as part of this epidemic of fabrication that we've been unfortunately having to deal with, coming from a lot of sources where verification is not possible because the information is untrue. When we do have a general kind of skepticism, I think, that when it comes to information as being made available, and I think perhaps where it relates to the whistleblowers is a questioning of their motives in making the information available. And I think, for example, when it comes to the a lot of people on the left are very unhappy with Julian Assange because they view him as having served as an instrument of Russian election meddling in 2016. And here in particular, we're talking about the publication of the emails from within the Democratic National Committee that showed certain things going on there. It showed that the DNC heavily favored Hillary's candidacy over Bernie Sanders, and this nourished the sense of grievance that Sanders backers have when it comes to the party establishment, the belief that they didn't give Sanders an even break and they didn't really look carefully at just how much popularity he could command because they were already committed. They're already in the bag for Hillary. Now, that information, those emails came out and it got tremendous play And it appears that that information was, the allegation is that that information came from Russian hackers who handed it off to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, who made it available to the U.S. media. So in that respect, his motive, because Assange was believed to be very, very hostile to Hillary, because Hillary had said very terrible things about him back in 2010 when she was Secretary of State, and some of the information that WikiLeaks published came from the State Department, and it included information about kind of nefarious wiretapping that was going on at the United Nations, really under the auspices of the State Department, and embarrassed Hillary no end. So she had kind of vowed vengeance and hostility toward Assange going back in 2010, and he naturally took that as legitimating his efforts to go ahead and damage and her candidacy, which is what that leak from the DNC kind of did. Particularly, you may remember that the DNC leak came on the same day as the Access Hollywood film was made available from NBC. That's where the candidate, well, at the time he was a TV guy, Donald Trump, was bragging about his prowess when it came to women in Hollywood, bragging about grabbing them by the genitals and the like. That had hit the media the same that morning, and was heading for a pretty hefty play for at least the duration of that news cycle, if not more. And an hour or so later came the DNC leaks from WikiLeaks, and it looked to a lot of people as though that the DNC leak were timed to blunt the impact of the Access Hollywood disclosures to the benefit of Donald Trump. Excuse
me. Coughing
here.
Yeah, I actually didn't recall that they were the same day, but it's interesting. Obviously, Clinton had called for, whether half humorously, for a drone to take out Assange, so there was no question he was against her candidacy. And obviously,
right.
Putin would have been as well, whatever Donald Trump was. Clinton had run a very out front, overt campaign saying she was going to get into Putin's face and implement a no-fly zone over Syria. So there's no question that Putin, he actually said at one point that he did favor Trump, but this is it's interesting how this works out. If you have information that you can use to hurt people, we've had blackmail, and obviously I have no situations where politicians have been blackmailed in order to stay in office, even, and not to say certain things. It goes with the territory, I guess. But the essence of your article.
I did want to raise another point here, and I think that it is important to recognize that there is a lot of information that's secret for good reason. And arguing on behalf of whistleblowers who leak secrets is not an argument for the kind of unbridled and promiscuous disclosure of things that are properly kept secret, because disclosing them would be harmful. It would be genuinely harmful to the interests of the state, the interests of the public, and all the rest. So let's be clear that my argument in favor of the whistleblowing cases is not an argument in favor of unbridled release of state secrets. It does, however, argue that we need to look at what things are being kept secret and ask why. And I don't know, of the cases I have tracked, I don't really know of any discernible harm that has been alleged to have taken place because of the release of these secrets. Now, I know that there are people out there that will dispute that and will say, well, you know, the privacy of these conversations is something that deserves respect, which is oftentimes true, and that, you know, State Department people will not be disclosing, will not be giving frank and honest assessments of what's going on in the countries where they're posted if they think that that information is going to be made public, and there's probably some truth to that as well. But I've sort of really would welcome some great news organization to take the 2010 leaks of Chelsea Manning's information and now, with the comfort of 9 years later, have a look at what the impact of those leaks was. Who got hurt? Did we really lose any intelligence assets? Did anybody get? I've never heard anybody show me some kind of some discernible harm that was done by that. And I would like some third party to go and weigh in and have a look and track those leaks around the world and see what happened as a result. And you hear anecdotally that there's some countries out there that learned because the State Department cables that were disclosed were so well researched and so well written that people in the countries that are at issue didn't learn things about their own governments that they never knew before, and they cannot now refer to the operations of their own government without making reference to those leaked State Department cables, because the information was so good and so valuable. And you'd like to know whether, on balance, the world was made a better place or a worse place thanks to these leaks. That would certainly help us to know whether we should be quite as ferocious in punishing the people who leaked this information if we knew how much harm they did, or, on the other hand, how much benefit they did.
Well, you point out the benefit from the release of the cables is really kind of exposed the U.S. operations in Iraq, Afghanistan. I actually looked through some of the cables and did find some things that would embarrass certain officials of foreign governments who are working behind the scenes with Washington.
Right.
It didn't get any publicity here, but there were so many cables. I don't know anyone, actually, who actually went through all these cables. It would take a long time to do that, and perhaps it would... Someday somebody will catalog them. I mean, they have been cataloged, but in terms of finding out what's useful today, and as far as
that's right,
as Syria.
Well, yeah, right. Well, I mean, you could confine yourself to the information that was made public by the media, and it is true. There's a lot of stuff that was made public abroad because it was relevant to the countries involved that didn't find much of an audience here because the news media here didn't think there'd be that much interest in them. But if you confine yourself to the stuff that actually was made public in the press or in the news media in various places, and had a look, well, you know, what happened? And it is obviously embarrassment is a consideration, but embarrassment may not be the only thing that factors into whether something should be made public. Sometimes people are doing things they deserve to be embarrassed about. So, you know, there you are. I'm just saying that we speculate as to the harm versus the benefit done by these disclosures, and we ought to be able to know what the reality is. And that obviously it's a difficult and burdensome and laborious process to sort that out, but I don't see how we can condemn this and continue to try to persecute and imprison the people who are responsible for it unless we have a sure sense that they did some harm.
You actually, in your article, you point out in your concern, you write that news is in danger and news isn't a person, it's a process which desperately needs protecting. And the element of that process as most in peril is the source. And for all his sins, real and alleged, Julian Assange has been one of the most extraordinary sources of the new millennium. That's a hell of a statement.
Well, I mean, I think it's true. What I worry about now is how little about the information we're not getting because potential sources are so frightened. because their surveillance is so much more effective on the part of the state. And because, I don't know what we're not learning about our diplomacy. I don't know really what's going on with our diplomacy with North Korea. It's very hard to sort of discern from the information that's being made available. And as you pointed out, I was unaware about the WikiLeaks information at Venezuela and about U.S. Meddling there, but I'd like to know more about that. And the question here is, with that kind of assault on sources, what is it that we're not learning that we wish we knew? I'd like to know more about our diplomacy toward Iran. Here we are, we're sending more battle groups to, you know, to fend off an Iranian aggression. I'd like to know more about what's behind that. But I fear that there are people who might, in an earlier age and perhaps a less technologically fearful age, we might have been getting this information. Our better national security reporters might have been getting that information from inside the government, and they're not now. And I wonder, we're, to that degree, the public is kind of flying blind.
One of the best sources for that is the Israeli press. Which is in English, which is available to the mainstream media, but they rarely quote from it. But in this case, as I mentioned in introductory remarks before I called you, that the information about the threats from Iran came from Israeli officials who visited Washington and met with Mr. Bolton, who is probably the hawkish person in Washington. And people have said, well, this is a diversion from the Mueller report and so on, but it's part of a long-term policy that that Bolton has pursued. And of course, Israel and the Saudis see Iran as the enemy and would like the United States to do its bidding and deal with Iran. But there's no evidence that has been shown that Iran has done anything. And also, it's interesting that the Pentagon and the CIA have opposed the Trump administration's position on Iran. This was a front-page article in the New York Times a few weeks ago, but there's been very little comment on, I haven't seen any comment about that from any columnists. But the New York Times yesterday or today did repeat that the Pentagon, the CIA, are concerned with the U.S. moves in Iran because it put U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Syria in jeopardy.
That's certainly possible. We have a very small number of soldiers there, so it seems to me that's a little bit of a fig leaf. Well, the idea that we're defending our forces, because every statement I've seen say, well, we're defending our forces and our interests, which is rather broadly defined.
The Pentagon said they're concerned that the connections between Iran and Iraqi militias will then lead the United States soldiers to be in jeopardy, even if it's a handful of people, even one soldier killed in a situation could start something. But the information is available in the Israeli press, except the U.S. doesn't take advantage of it. My guest is Ed Wasserman. We've been actually talking about Julian Assange and Ed Snowden and the cracking down on sources. What do you think is the outlook for the future under this administration, or even the next?
They're going to be even more aggressive. Sessions already indicated he's got a lot of leak investigations underway. And they haven't come to fruition yet, but I think there'll be more prosecutions of sources. There's certainly the possibility they'll go after reporters as well, although they haven't. They've talked about it, and Trump himself has talked about cracking down and changing libel law, this, that, and the other. Clarence Thomas has talked about reversing one of the seminal press protection rulings, which is Times v. Sullivan from the mid-60s, which gave a lot of leeway to the press in printing information about public officials. I think there will be more prosecutions of sources at a minimum. And I think that the other impact, which is one which is harder to discern, is going to be a further chilling of the flow of publicly significant information that has the stamp of secrecy on it, which oftentimes is the information we need in order to make sense of official policy and understand exactly what's going on in Washington. Washington and the way policies are being assessed. So I think it's there's good reason to be apprehensive about the outlook.
This is a strange time because we're going into the 2020 elections, which is going to continue. We have the questions about the coverage of the Mueller report, and it's like parallel universes with the Republicans and the Democrats, one interpreting it one way, one interpreting it the other way. What kind of impact is this crackdown going to have on the coverage? Are we going to see this thing through 2020?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, it's interesting how carefully the Mueller report was assembled and how few leaks were available from that. And it could very well be the suppression of the Mueller report is going to just induce a certain number of people in the federal bureaucracy to start talking to reporters again. If the intended effect of having an independent counsel or an independent investigation, which is to make this information available to the public, if that's now being blocked, the legitimate release of the report is being blocked, then you very well may find yourself seeing the illegal release of the report. So this kind of thing can backfire, and even though I think the repression and the kind of surveillance that sources are under now generally serves to freeze that flow of information, we could find the opposite effect if they overplay their hand and more people are then disgusted and are determined to make this information publicly available. So, we need to wait and see. There are a lot of reporters out there that are eager for this kind of information. I think there are more people within the bureaucracy maybe willing to help them.
Well, Ed Wasserman, Dean of Journalism at UC, thank you so much for shedding some light in your opinions on this subject today. Glad to have you as our guest.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.